Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy?
Fall Guy.
That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
You're listening to the Companion Gun Dog Podcast. I'm your host, Grayson Geyer, and with me today is Stump, Captain Stump. We recorded an episode together, episode before last, and we're going to get back to it today. We're going to probably make this a bit of a regular check-in with Stump, since he and I are going to be working together in the fall and trying to get some dogs out west, as we spoke about in the last podcast. Stump, how you doing, man?
I'm doing great, Grayson. Good to hear from you, brother.
Yeah, man. I appreciate you coming on again, and we're going to get into it. But also on today's episode, we're going to kind of be introducing Stump's kind of new endeavors in regards to media. So looking forward to some of that. Anything exciting going on in your life besides that, man? You've been fishing a lot? What's going on?
Yeah. You know, when weather will allow, we've had a really crazy spring. It's super windy, and weather's just odd for South Carolina this time of year. Still enjoying it, though, because it's cool. And I'm working with the King Cat Tournament Trail. We're traveling across the country, filming a show for the Pursuit Network, all around the Catfish Tournament Trail, sponsored by Johnny Marsh, Bass Pro Shop, Cabela's, little plug. and we're fishing, and we got a litter of pups here. And so, and when I'm traveling out after these tournaments, I've been taking a couple dogs on the road with me. And things are good. They're busy. It's a busy time of year, and it's hot, tough for working dogs right now. So we're just doing the best we can with dogs and having fun otherwise.
Yeah, tell me about it, man. This is, it's been a couple of years now, but I completely quit doing bird work for the public, at least during the summertime. I'll still normally pull a few dogs out and do pigeon work. And this year I've got one invitational prep dog, NAVD invitational prep dog, that's got to stay steady through the summer. And unfortunately, with that game, the invitational always happens in September, and it just irks me to no end. And I mean, I understand they try their best to keep everything out of the hunting season,
right?
And it's just good timing. And a lot of those folks aren't from down south, but it's so miserable trying to keep a dog put together over the summer and continue progressing in bird work when the cover is just wet and dense and it's 1,000% humidity and
it's brutal. It's brutally hot and it's too tough to do it, and the bugs and the snakes all too bad. But it brings me to a point that I was going to say, once we're talking about being on the road, it's hard to condition a companion gun dog when you live in the southeast to be ready to hit Montana in September when you can see, you know, high 70s, low 80s in the middle of the day in a hot, dry, arid, rocky, sandy soil. So it's a concern of mine that we get them so soft during the summer.
Well, you know, I mean, what I've started doing, at least with my own dogs, is I swim them hard every day. And I know that's not, I know it's not a you know, a good kind of supplement to running them, especially working them on birds. But I figure it's the best I got. So I try to give everybody, you know, probably 300 or 400 yards of swimming hard every day. And I feel like they get out of the back end of the summer really fit, but it doesn't translate completely for sure. Especially when we talk about that darn humid heat, dry heat you get out west. It's so different.
It's so different when you take them from here straight out to there and you put them on the ground. Yeah. It'd be 30-minute, hour runs if your dogs aren't conditioned. So.
Oh, and their feet.
And their feet, too. You got to run them, man. If you got a place where you can road them a little bit, you got a golf cart and a safe place to do that, that's a good idea.
I agree 100%. Yeah, last time I went, Montana, it's been a few years back, but I remember coming back through South Dakota. It was nearly 100 degrees, and that was like late September. They had a hot spell, and it was wild, man. So, you can't ever be too prepared, have the dogs too conditioned, and be ready to put them down and pick them right back up and get them cool and get some water on them.
Another concern too, if there are folks that, and we'll talk more about it later. I jumped to the reminders just because we were leaning on it a little bit, but I know you got an aversion clinic coming up, snake aversion, and that's a real concern out there. I was reluctant to go into places that felt super snaky to me out there. Those rocky outcroppings where I felt like we were more likely to find chukar when those temperatures are high. I'm like, yeah, let's just keep them down here. And I don't even know that I was correct, that those snakes wouldn't be just as prevalent down there as they would up there. But every Western movie I've ever seen, one of those rocky outcroppings held a rattler up there.
That's good enough for me, man. I Western diamondbacks scare me. All those Western
venoms. It's that Mojave who's the bad summer gun.
Yeah, and I spent some time in Southern California training bomb dogs, and there would be signs, you know, like you'd be hiking out in the middle of the desert, and they'd be like, high concentration Mojave Viper area. And, we just turned around when we saw that.
Yeah, man. So I'm sure I've gotten you off track of what you kind of had in mind for us to go about. So we can.
Today's pretty informal, and I reckon this is the way we'll keep it with you and me. We'll let the conversation kind of take a little bit of its own course, but there's some points I do want to hit. First and foremost, you said you got a litter on the ground. We know it's French Brittany's. Tell us a little bit about what you got going there.
Yep. These dogs are off of Fred Overby's dog, Sasquatch, and my dog, Ruthie, who is a puppy off of your dog, Pete, and my dog, Eula.
Yep.
And they're 6 weeks now. They're exceptional, orange and whites. We get like half the litter's roan, half's clear and white. They're 4 females, 2 males. They're developing nicely. We were fortunate to live in a neighborhood, and I have some good friends. One's here with us today. We're going to introduce them in a bit, Connell O'Brien. Connell has 5 kids, and my buddy Jeffers Gardner has 5 kids, ranging from responsible to you better keep an eye on that one. And and they all come over and handle the dogs several times a week and help us with them if we're not here. So these puppies are as well socialized as you can get. So they help us. I think we touched on puppies a little bit last time and conditioning. I know you wanted me to mention this. So some of the things we do with them, starting from really when the day they're born, is we handle them all daily. You know, you're keeping up with weights and making sure everybody's growing, making sure the mom's producing milk. We're feeding her up. We're handling those pups. There's a whole protocol for doing it. You can look it up. I won't bore y'all with the details, but we handle them and we put them in somewhat precarious positions for just a few seconds. And it supposedly builds some mental strength in them later on. So we do that. And, you know, that's real soft, gentle stuff that you do daily. But you're putting hands on the pups. So by the time they're this age, they're coming to you willingly. They know how to nuzzle you already and nest in. We do some sound conditioning with them too when we're feeding them. I just use the dog food bag and crackle it a little bit when they first start feeding, and they're curious about the sound at first, and we just build it up until at this age I let them start clamoring for food. They know they're on a schedule, so I Pavlov'd them. I ring the dinner bell. I thump the top of the dog food bowl and get them at the gate, and I can come out popping that 50-pound Purina Pro Plan bag, and those pups are just clamoring for the food. You know, they're unaffected by loud noises at this point in an expected situation. So
sure.
That's just something, you know, the kind of stuff we try and do to them all the time so that when they go home with somebody, they've already got a really good foundation. You know, we've stopped the biting and chewing and all that, and just trying to make a balanced dog and send them out to homes in a good way.
Yeah, I mean, you know, personally, I'm a deep believer in exposing puppies to as much environmental stimulation as you possibly can. You know, whether we're talking loud noises, different textures, different smells, just different environments in general. And that way, hopefully when they leave the nest, if you will, it's not their first exposure to novel, you know, sensations or stimuli.
Oh, exactly. I'm sorry I interrupt you, but once they've had their first vaccinations, we start introducing them to some different covers. We take them out. They ride in the dog box in the kennel. They have that experience with hay. They've been crated and slept. We'll start housebreaking them. Everything we do if the puppies in like just their 10-week program is set them up for a really good life. They've got a great foundation with exposure to all that stimuli, scent, smells, different covers, a bird introduction, just dead bird or a quail on a string, you know, for them to chase around, or even in a cage. Just building a little drive in them. We work with retrieve a little bit. You know, they don't know what they're doing exactly. They're just picking up something, carrying it around. But, you know, that turns into something in a hurry at 12 and 14 weeks.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think whatever you can throw at them within reason, that's obviously, you know, not a bridge too far. All that sounds phenomenal. But you mentioned you had a 10-week program. Is that right?
Well, I like to hold them till 10. I'll allow clients, and I kind of qualify them.
Sure.
You know, what do they want out of the dog? And I like to keep them to 10. That allows me 3 more weeks of observation and 3 more weeks of that stimulation that you're talking about. You know, these kids are coming over. They're noisy. They're wild. They're near about feral. And so these puppies, they've seen a good bit of what the world's going to throw at them in the first few months, barring something extraordinary. So if I can keep them till 10, we'll do that. We are considering starting, you know, we only make a couple of litters a year, and we're already pretty dog heavy around here for us. But we're considering doing a puppy program similar to what Emily at Shotgun and Short Hairs does.
Yep.
She's advised me on it a bit, and keeping these pups a little bit longer and completing the house breaking and starting some of the informal hunting training.
I would definitely, you know, I mean, and for those that can't tell, I mean, this is a real-time conversation. This is not something we've discussed moving forward, but I would certainly say that that's where the market demand is. You know, I think folks are any opportunity to avoid, you know, some of the stressors that come along with puppyhood, and of course, give them a head start. I mean, you've got an environment, you've got the know-how, you've got the resources to kind of give these pups a good start. So I would say, yeah, absolutely. And, you know, and there's certainly ideas on when to separate litters and things like that. But, you know, I there's not a lot of raw data out there that we can draw on to know what's perfect. We got people's anecdotes over, you know, over time. And personally, I think it's, you know, the proof's in the pudding, and there's especially from these last Pete Eula litters, a lot of hokum poke pups out there, you know, putting their feet in the right places.
Yeah, and I'm not locked on the 10-week thing, and that's why I say from 7 to 10 is when we let them go. I feel like 7's long enough, sure. And if you got a place where you're going to take it and continue that, do it. And if you want me to hold on to it for 3 more, I'm happy to. I like having them around. What I think is happening sometimes, though, we're sending some of these dogs homes to homes who they have their predetermined expectations. You're a professional trainer. I'm a hunter and I'm a breeder, and I'm just a guy that learned the hard way kind of how to manage dogs, and I still require a lot of help to get them steadied up right. But we're sending these dogs home. Some of them are kind of high caliber and they're a handful, and they don't get the right stimulation and exercise and foundation, and they sort of run amok. And you don't want to have situations where it's not a good relationship, good partnership with the dog and family. So anything I can do to solidify that kind of foundation for the owner and the dog, I'd prefer to do.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I picked up a new lab pup yesterday, and I think he's 7 weeks. I'm pretty sure he is. You can tell how much effort and thought I put into it when I'm getting my new pups. But, you know, one thing, if I could get a puppy that was crate broke before that rascal came to my house, that would be worth its weight in gold. You know, just to have one that you could put in the crate, was comfortable in there already, understood how to relax, be quiet in its time there, and then come out and go do its business and go back to normal. I mean, I would absolutely happily wait till, what you know, another month to get that from my breeder.
Right. And after first shots, we start that with them. That starts in the outside kennel. And then we'll crate them in the evenings, and we sort of read them too. We do it when it's easy to do it, when they're tired. Let them play in the yard, then bring them in and put them all in a large dog crate together. They go to sleep together. Everybody's comfortable, good to go. So it's a stress free way of crate training, where it just becomes a happy, safe place for them. So when they go home with you, they already know the crate. They're like, yeah, put me in there. I know what to do in there.
It's interesting. I'm interested to see how all that plays out going forward. You know, something we haven't really discussed, though, is maybe, you know, both of our involvement in the French Brittany community too deeply. And for those that don't know, you know, how long have you had them, Stump? I guess it was Eula your first?
Yep, Eula was my first, man. And I honestly, tell you the truth, years ago when I was a young man and just getting out of the house, early 20s, I had an affinity for bird dogs. I'd already owned several, but I was looking for something better, and there were Brittany's for sale out in the country, $75 a piece. And I'll try and keep this short. And I went out and bought one of those Brittany's, and they were feral. I've used that word twice tonight, but Grayson, they had been unsocialized. They were out there with some deer hounds back behind this guy's house. I finally got one caught up. It bit me. It peed on me. But I was like, I can work him through it. And I couldn't work that dog through it. It took me about 2 weeks, and he was lost. And I carried it back to the guy, and I left with that same one and another one. It was just as bad. I can't remember that guy's name, but never buy a car from out there and live. It might be.
Oh, that's awesome.
So I didn't realize until I was looking for a dog. I'd been hunting woodcock over flushers, and it wasn't working for clients.
Sure.
Covers. So I want a pointing dog. I don't remember if we talked about this last time or not.
No, we didn't. And, honestly, I don't think I've ever – I know you had a Springer at one point, but
I had a couple Springers, and I had a lab that hunted woodcock. I was shopping for dogs, man, and, you know, everything was short hairs, and they did. They looked great to me, and I saw where people were having some good success with them hunting and family-wise. But it was a bigger dog than I wanted. I liked the size of my Springers. Yeah. and the French Brittany came across my radar. I can't even tell you where. And I started digging around. Oh, I was down in the forest hunting with my Springers, and I met a guy, and you've met him. He gave us a ride on the tailgate down there.
That sounds familiar.
Richard Cullerton, Mr. Richard Cullerton.
Okay.
And he and Jim Anders had worked together.
Oh, and no kidding.
He knew Jim and fought me, and he had short hairs. And I was telling him I was considering seeing these French Britneys, and he said, call my friends Jim and fought me. Gave me their number. I reached out. They put me in touch with Dan Parler down in Somerville, and man, I got fired up for a dog. I went down there to Dan's and saw a couple, and he had a litter that were all spoken for, but I went to meet him and see the kennel and all of that, and we got a tennis ball out, and three or four of those puppies we put out on the ground, and they were just racing for the ball and racing back to you, and would – I mean, these are little tiny little puppies now, 6 weeks old, and they would tumble you over on the return, you know, just crash into you with the ball. And I'm like, holy cow, that's a bird dog. And so I put a deposit down, and like 6 months later, maybe I got Eula, and she was the damnedest thing I'd ever seen. She was a handful, man. She would just run as hard and fast as she could with, honestly, no fear or concern of what was in front of her or behind her. And she would, like, look the other direction and just keep running full steam ahead. And I was like, this dog's going to kill herself. And she tried to. She ended up hurting her leg with that hard charging stuff when she was real young. But, sorry, I wandered a bit. But she started it all for me, and I got her, and I immediately wanted more. So 2 years later, I got another. A year later, another. And fast forward to now, we own six, possibly seven, and there's a litter of 6 years. So there's like 15 dogs around here right now.
Well, I mean, that's awesome, man. And you know, I think it's neat that that's where you wound up. I know you'd had some pointers in the past. I've always meant to ask you about this. It just never, you know, we can't keep a conversation straight. And I'm sure that the audience is learning that right now.
Yeah. Well, but, I was young when I got my first bird dogs, and I didn't have a clue. Birds were hard to find, getting harder to find. I had hunted in my high school days with a buddy. His dad was a bird hunter. There were a few older guys that led me to want to do this. But my first pointers were horseback trial dogs that were washouts. And one of them was okay, the other not so good. And we killed some birds together. But I kind of do it all. I'm a wing shooter, man. Anything, ducks, doves, quail, anything with feathers. And so I was looking for one dog does it all by the time I got to the French Brittany. And after Eula, I was like, this is the most amazing animal I've ever seen in my life. She tops out at about 36 pounds. At 6 months old, she was retrieving Canadian geese out of the pond that weighed, you know, 8 to 10 pounds. And she couldn't haul them up the bank forward, so she'd get on the bank and grab them by the neck and drag them up the hill.
And I remember, I don't know how old Eula was when I first got my hands on her, but I remember being thoroughly impressed and doing a deep dive on her background because I wanted more of that.
She's hard driven. No does not mean no to Eula. She can take any kind of pressure you'll give her. She is unbothered by it. If you correct Eula, Eula just thinks I need to figure out a way to do that without getting corrected. You know, she's not like, oh, I need to stop doing that.
I would call that a good training dog. That's what you're aiming at.
No. I'm saying like flushing birds on her own. She still to this day, you'll go on a woodcock hunt and Eula will wander off and come back with that glazed look in her eyes. And you know, she's just going and ripped her two or three. And then she'll come back and get in the hunt.
Well, I can appreciate that, man. And you know, we haven't, I think, dug too deep into this, but, you know, Yula being a parlor dog, as far as I know, that line was heavy in Irish blood. And I think that's something we've lost in the French Brittany. And I'm not sure there's too many people out there that are, number one, probably interested, but number two, understand that, you know, for a few generations, we were importing dogs from Ireland that were doing really well over here.
And that's hard to find.
Yeah, they were gritty dogs. I mean, when I think of the dog, my favorite dogs in the French Brittany's, I love Fred's dogs. I love Italian dogs. I mean, Atos is a big player in my kennel. You know, and obviously there's plenty of great French dogs. But there was an era where we were getting these Irish dogs and they were just tough. You know, could handle pressure, loved cover, unlike what you consider in most pointing breeds. I thought of them more like a spaniel, in a lot of ways. And I'm worried that's been lost, and it's something that I'm trying to hang on to. And, you know, one thing I think with using Yula heavily in my kennel, Ella has quite a bit of that Irish blood as well. And I've spoken to other trainers that acknowledge it and find it valuable, but, or breeders. But I don't know what we're going to do moving forward to keep that kind of gritty EB around.
Well, I've located a half sister of Yula, and we're going to go back to her. We haven't decided exactly who yet. We got a couple ideas, and that should pull some of that back again and give us a chance to maybe get it. You know, I don't know. That part is nature, but I'll tell you, with the aspect that you mentioned and training these dogs, they change the way I train. They don't take hard discipline well. Even the gritty ones. Well, now Yula, yeah. She trains like a Chesapeake, but she's an exception.
Sure. No, I understand what you're saying. I mean, EBs have a reputation for being quote unquote soft.
Right. Well, they're prima donnas. You know, they squeal sometimes at the slightest pain, but they all say that they're smart. They don't want that pain again. They learn quickly and they're bold dogs. And, but you're right. The Yula, Olin, I hate to say this because this is kind of a very general statement, but my roan dogs break the cover like a Labrador hunting pheasants. You know, they hunt them like flushers. If you put them in the thick stuff, they still point their birds, but they hit it hard.
That's what I'm getting at. And I think that's their, you know, when we talk field work, that's an important attribute to me. And there's not many pointing dogs out there that have that. And there's not many EBs out there that have that. You know, a lot of dogs prefer to stay on the outside of the cover and win their birds and kind of tiptoe around. And that's important because you need cautious dogs. But, you know, one of my favorite pheasant dog I've ever owned personally is Crockett. And that's a Yula son. And that rascal, I mean, he's not the best at any other type of bird, but he can certainly get to a pheasant and pin it. And he has that effect on a pheasant. He just knows how to keep it on the ground. And that's a really neat quality, but he goes where they are.
Well, he had an afternoon in South Dakota where he had about 600 encounters in about 45 minutes.
I remember you telling me that. For those that don't know, I got Crockett a little later in life and Stump started with him. Yeah, he definitely did not have the skill of keeping them on the ground early in life.
No, he could make them fly, though, sure enough. He could.
Well, I'm glad we had that little kind of trip down the EB lane. You know, it's a moving target, kind of producing that perfect bird. And I'm not sure there's a lot of folks out there talking about breeding and what they take into account, but so much of it is a guessing game. So much of it is throwing things at the wall and hoping they're going to stick and doing your best and trying to produce that perfect type of dog you're looking for. And, you know, and for me personally, I think you know, having that great pet and that companion dog is really important. So I want a dog that it's handler oriented, affectionate by nature, but none of that matters if they're not giving me what I want in the field. And the special thing about the type of EBs I like is that toughness, that grittiness, that willingness to challenge cover, a natural retrieve, and a little bit of point tossed in there to help, you know, but that's my job as a trainer is to kind of polish that up.
Well, and I want that as a breeder, and then I want them to go to a home where that foundation is already solid and it not get lost in the translation. I think there are opportunities in these dogs' lives. So I try not to let mine bark. This is just an example. And I do that by screaming hush a whole lot. And my neighbors probably would rather hear the dogs bark than me yelling hush. But even with the puppies, if there's a situation where those puppies are barking, I try and go ahead and stop it right now so that that barking doesn't become something that that puppy is used to sitting out there doing. Sure. You know what I mean? Yeah, so it doesn't become an ingrained moment. And then a little bit of retrieve. I feel like I always explain it to my friends. Is there moments, and I see this with kids too. This is just, and I speak well below my level of intelligence on this, but there are opportunities to open doors permanently. There are opportunities to open windows, and then there are opportunities to close doors. By closing doors, I mean like shocking, scaring a puppy and creating a gun-shy dog. You can avoid that. In most instances, sometimes a natural occurrence will make it happen, but you can also build that stuff and you teach that puppy to start learning early and those doors just continue to open. And if you close them and you crate that dog all day long and you don't give it its time and you don't stimulate it mentally and physically, well, that's when you run into dogs that come to you and then are a problem.
Yeah, I mean, I couldn't agree more. And this is something we've covered at length on the podcast is, you know, what do you do when you get your puppy, you know, and for me, it's ritualize that lifestyle and let them know what a crate is, make sure they're comfortable in there, but also get them out and carry them everywhere you can, you know, and you know, as breeders, we're concerned with what we're producing by nature. We have whatever influence in the time we get with them, that we've got, and we have to believe that that matters. Or why put the effort in, you know? So nobody, I mean, that's always the question is nature versus nurture. What, you know, what weighs more heavily? And all you can do is do your best at both.
Well, that's right. And I mean, and then like we said, there's no perfect situation, but there's genetic, there's environmental, and there's a lot you can do environmentally to build desire and prey drive, to build retrieve, to build recall. You can do all that. It's a lot easier to do in a young puppy than it is in a 6-month-old that's been crated all day, and you try and teach him that when you've let him out for 15 minutes after work in the evening.
Sure.
I'm sorry. I know we had a couple of other topics.
Well, we'll get to them. I think that was important. I enjoyed this conversation.
Okay. All right.
You know,
I'm sorry.
That's why
I drag you off track.
No, it's good. You don't do as good a job as Emily does at keeping me on track, but that's not what this episode's about. We're here to kind of spitball a little bit, and I think we're doing okay with it. So, the idea being, hey, you bred to one of Fred's dogs. When we say that, we're talking about an Italian dog, a graceful dog, fast dogs in the field to Eula, who is a gritty dog, a tough dog. We'll go anywhere to get a bird, and maybe not what you might consider as graceful as one of the Italian type of dogs.
Oh, not at all.
Or as maybe as confirmationally, and I don't mean this like she's a perfect EB in terms of confirmation, but she doesn't have those that look. If it makes
right.
Sense.
Oh yeah, yeah. There's nothing gallant about her. She's but if you look on the CEBUS website, that little pencil diagram of what the dog should look like
yep.
She fits in that thing, and there's nothing pretty about it either.
Well, that's it. But man, I sure do. I mean, to me, those Pellegrinotti dogs are my favorite to look at. My favorite to hunt over are always the Ellas and the Eulas of the world. Those pushy dogs that they do what's needed to bring game to the bag. That's what we have them for. So.
Well, I value Fred's opinion and the history of the breed enough, and so I consort with him on what I do. And I think Fred's pretty lenient and amuses me and allows me to to play a part in what he spent a lifetime doing. But, you know, in this day and age and the way breeding goes, you can't develop a line now, and you can't do it on your own. You can't do it without help. I think it's That's important that breeders work together and make sure that we've got healthy dogs. And most of what I've been doing have been outcrossings, which don't necessarily breed you typical type of dogs, although Yule and Pete put pretty good squeeze to them.
We got a little bit of Irish on top of Irish there with Ella over Eula.
Yeah.
And then going back to Fred's stuff, I think is a perfect, you know, if you think of that Italian blood as spice, you know, and that's a, and Fred has a very well-defined line. When we say Fred, we're talking about our friend Fred Overby, who is a breeder out of Georgia with the kennel, gosh, I'm going to butcher this. Damas de Patala.
Yeah, or Lador.
Yeah, and Lador is that, yeah. His kennel name is Patala Power.
La Patrie.
Lador. Yeah, the Lador line comes straight out of France and is an extension of the Pellegrinotti line, which is an older Italian line.
Well, you know, those dogs have great chest, great slope. Yep, nice heads, beautiful color. They're clear white and orange. And honestly, when I first researched Eula and the picture of Pellegrinotti with, like, I don't know, he's got 7-9 dogs on a lead in front of him, I'm like, oh, yeah, I'm doing that.
And that's it. And so, and I think that's, and I mean, that is, that's what we're all aiming at to get to conformationally. And I would, there's nothing I'd rather hunt over out west or, you know, or in Georgia, especially. And I mean, he and his dogs are accomplished on every type of game bird. They're great. And it's they're not beautiful. To say they're lacking. Yeah. And it's not to say they're lacking in any place. It's that when I think of, yeah, there's something to be said for that kind of spaniel type grittiness that Eula brings to the table. And I think it's a great combination. So I'm excited about Sasquatch. I guess we can get ourselves out of that hole. We've been chatting about it. But I think that's a great one. And I think it leaves room down the line for all sorts of fun stuff. And so I hope I get to see, and get my hands on some of these puppies in the near future. So what other things? No, go ahead.
These pups are coming to you. You'll be seeing them.
Well, hopefully. So I guess we've kind of touched on your background a bit, and we know you've had springers and stuff. At some point, I'd really like to talk to you more. We won't do it tonight about your experiences with flushing dogs on woodcock, because I think. I think there are people out there. I think woodcock are becoming a more popular resource in the Southeast.
Yep.
And I think there are people that are going to be spending more time hunting them with flushing dogs. And I think it's something, just an interesting topic to cover, but I don't want to go down that whole night. But I it's something that in the future I want to touch on. What I really want to get to is what you got going on.
So on the dog aspect of things, I have a friend here with me. We'll introduce him tonight. He'll be involved with this. Connell O'Brien's here with us. Connell, tell him hello.
Hey, Grayson, Stuff, what's up?
Hey, buddy.
Hey, Connell.
Connell's going to be involved with us. We filmed a pilot episode for a show called Backroads and Bird Dogs, and we're going to do a podcast that coincides with it that'll kind of overview the show and discuss what we talk about, you know, each episode. The show, of course, will be 30 minutes and won't show everything, so we'll discuss more in depth what that is. But it's based around, it's a companion gun dog show, man. It's going to be based on the dogs primarily, and then their relationships, the people that they take me to meet, and the back roads we travel to go and see those guys, different kennels, different friends we've made just through dogs alone. And over the course of it, we'll discuss a lot of conservation, voluntary restraint, promoting regrowth of habitat, and, you know, just responsible, ethical outdoor stuff. But we're going to have a good time doing it. We're going to drink beer. We're going to cook in the evenings. I've got a veterinary friend, Ryan James from Hartsville Animal Hospital. He'll be guesting on there, giving us the right medical advice for the dogs. You know, we'll discuss field stuff for dogs, traveling with dogs. Just like all the stuff you need to know to road trip if you're going to travel with dogs, how to read your maps, how to cook a chicken or a pheasant purloin. Just good times, man. Back roads and bird dogs. That's the focus of it, and the relationships between dogs and people and how they bring us together.
Yeah, I'm excited. I'm excited for that, man. I think it's, you know, there's more media in every place today than there ever has been, but it's a wonderful time to be, you know. I remember, man, when I was getting into this stuff, especially when I was getting into dogs, you know, it was the earliest days of the internet, and it was like you had to know a secret handshake to figure out how to do anything. And today there's so much information available, and there's room for more, it's an exciting time. And I think of all those kids out there in their early 20s through their, you know, early 50s, if they're getting into this for the first time, and they've just got so much more available to them to get started and to be successful early. However you define success, you know.
Right. Oh, exactly. And that's kind of what we want to do is what, you know, I think we may have discussed it last time, but the graduation of the hunter. When you're young, you want to kill your first one. Then you want to kill a limit. Then you want to kill a whole bunch of them. You want to kill a limit every time you go, and you reach that. And then as you get older, you see that, hold on, the fun part wasn't all this killing. And the fun part was the hunt, the pursuit. And once you learn to find it. So what we'll focus on, you know, is I want to help people not have to hit the same hurdles that I did learning all this stuff on the road, but I'm not hot spotting either. I'm not telling you how to go kill a bunch of birds. It's not a priority for us. It really never has been after my youthful bloodlust. So what it's about is just getting out there, enjoying it, being respectful of the landowners, the communities you go to, and, you know, making new friends and getting dogs out to do what they're meant to do.
No, yeah. You made a good point there too, Grayson. It's just I'm a guy that's got very little experience in the world of bird hunting, and I came upon Stump, and he was just a guy that was super into his dogs, into hunting, into teaching. So to be able to jump in with Stump and some of his friends, just experience this world of people who are so eager to share about their dogs, about the habitat, about what you're going to hunt. It's just been a awesome experience, and I think this show is going to be a lot about that, just helping other people know it's not that hard. Just get in with the right people and enjoy the ride.
Yeah, and I mean, I think of my best memories, you know, either in the field or associated with it. Some of them are with you, Stump. I mean, and just I think about, you know, processing some woodcock guts and trying to do things that way, but you know, some things are lost. You know, we've lost a little bit with all of this media, which is the figuring things out for yourself. And it sounds like, you know, what you got in mind is giving people enough to get excited about it, but also it's not a go find it on your own. You know, those days when you're in the field and you haven't been dropped a pin on an Onyx map by somebody, you've kind of stumbled into a place you never expected to find a bird in the first place, and then all of a sudden they're just getting up everywhere. Those are the magic moments, you know.
Yeah, man, I'm a fishing guide by trade. That's what I do for a living, or it's one of the things I do. And when I first started guiding fishing, and I'm happy for all my clients to hear this in a public confessional now. When I first started, I would carry these people straight to the fish, and I wanted to catch 20, you know, I wanted double digit fish every day.
Yeah.
And I saw my resource change over the course of the last 20 years. And, I saw the amount of effort people were willing to put into it and their level of expectation, for that sort of thing. So I changed my whole, marketing plan. And I tell, if anyone calls me now and says, "Hey, we've got a church social and we need 100 fish. I'm like, "I'm not your guy." you know, I'm catch and release. And I see the effect of technology on it. Boats, motors, spot lock trolling, you know, GPS. I mean, just so many things that make it easier for people to do. The magazines, the information that's out there is insane, man. And our grandfathers had none of that. They went fishing. And and that's the discovery part of it. Without that, I don't want it. Don't take me straight to it.
I think that's a wonderful point. And I think that's, you know, maybe, you know, kind of the direction to head in here as we wind her down is what is it to us, you know,
it's not success if you don't work for it.
Well, and it's, you know, it's not magic if it doesn't, you know, I think we're at a point in time where we can say, man, we, you know, you can go fishing with, what do they call that thing? Live view.
Yep.
You got, you know, live view, and you got a depth, I call it a fish finder or whatever. And, you know, we're not far off of that now with birds either. You know, I mean, I can easily have somebody drop me a pin, or you can look at Facebook, and I do it all the time.
Oh, yeah, look at migratory patterns on the radio.
Yeah.
There's so many things. Yeah,
I see people post pictures of, and I can look at the picture, and I know from the tree line, they're sitting in the middle of the woods, and I can see a rock and a tree line, and I go, I know exactly where that person is.
Yeah. And, oh, yeah, 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 that's right. And the same with the marsh down here with fishing. You can look, I know where that is.
Yeah, yeah. And it's, I mean, to everybody else, it's a completely, you know, innocuous background. You know, but for those of us that have put the time in or the effort in, you go, I completely expected people to find stuff there. And now it's been posted all over the internet. And not to say there's anything wrong with that. That's the world we live in today.
No, and let's talk about the other side of it. You know, let's not bash that. Do it if that's the way you want to do it. I don't care.
Sure.
But I've spent years riding back roads, dirt roads, you know, getting stuck in the mud, in the rain, drinking beer with my buddies, getting out and walking in that mess and trying 100 different spots until we figured out, oh, they're in the aspens, or oh, they're in the hardwoods, you know. Until
that
out and walk, you don't know that. You can look at all the maps in the world you want to.
And that completely reminds me of our trip to Minnesota a few years back when, you know, we just kept driving and driving and looking at these maps online and everything else. We were going to dial everything in perfect. And you said it to me. You're like, man, look at everything we're driving past.
We're sitting all day chasing maps, and grouse are running across the road in front of us.
Yeah, they're blowing off the side.
We got 30 more miles to get to the cutover.
And it's just, I mean, it's and that
cutover up there, you can't walk a cutover up there.
No. No, no, and it's same anywhere. You can't walk a cut over anywhere. You know, you're going to find birds there, but it's knowing how to approach it. And of course, are they wonderful places to work? They absolutely are. But between cutovers, there's plenty of micro terrain. There's plenty of cover changes. There's birds, and it's learning how to find them. You know, the only way you're going to get that experience, the knowledge, is through the experience. And that's where the magic is. And it's not in the finding the birds. It's in those moments where you sit in the cab of your truck with your buddy having a good laugh. You know, and the getting out and chasing the dogs is a big part of it, but it's not all.
No, well, exactly. And that's what back roads and bird dogs will show. And Connell will be a big part of that. Y'all get to meet him more. He's going to tune in when we do our podcast. Connell, he's not entirely new to this at this point. He came on board. You know, you get a lot of guys, and I won't keep you long with this either, that come on and hop, oh, I want to go, and they just want to get in the back seat and ride. And then you carry them halfway across the country, and they're like, oh, we've got to walk that far, you know, and that kind of nonsense. Well, Connell took shotgun and took over navigation and map reading, which is critical to me.
Sure.
I need that guy in my passenger seat, and I seldom have him. If not, yeah. I can do it, but there's a whole lot of cussing going on.
I wouldn't know. I have no clue what you're talking about.
And a lot of times I'll just pull over and just get out and go hunt wherever I am versus trying to drive across the county.
Yeah, sounds like a familiar story.
So Connell got right in there and he picked up on it and he picked up on natural woods navigation with the sun and stuff in Michigan. So I'm like, bro, you want to come back again? And so we become fast friends with that. And he owns a poodle pointer.
And a French Brittany.
Oh, yeah, and a French Brittany that he got from us. She's got a rare heart condition, honey, but she's a firecracker. Anyways, I want to speak to Connell. He didn't get in on this one tonight very much, but he'll be around more and more.
So, yeah. You guys got to sit and listen and learn. That's what it's about.
See what I mean? Isn't he a keeper?
That's it. So yeah, man, I guess it's as, you know, I'm excited. I'm excited for what's coming this year. You know, we're always trying to figure out when we can get together in the woods, and sometimes we hit it just right. Sometimes we miss it. But I'm sure this coming season, we've got a lot of good woods time ahead of us. I know I've got a few clients that are hoping to send some dogs with you. You got dates on the books for what your plans are for hunting?
I've got them softly mapped out right now, Grayson. I'm not ready to share them. Okay. I will with you off of this thing, and we can start looking. Some of them are going to be a couple of quick ones that may not even make sense. I've had a tournament schedule change that's kind of got my fall a little bit wonky. There's going to be some coming and going. And
gotcha.
I'm looking at logistics, but I just don't know exactly how to work that out right now. But there will be a long trip in the fall starting in, I think, late October.
Okay.
Mid to late October, and then I'm going to be gone. And then January, I'd say shortly after Christmas, after first of the year, I'm going to go west again, probably for most of January.
All right. Well, that'll, you know, hopefully folks that need to get their dogs on the road listening, they can holler at me and we'll try to get something lined up if you need to get your dog out there and in birds. Something I haven't dropped on the podcast yet to this point, I don't think, is we've set dates for that St. Hubert trial.
All right.
So I'm hoping to have you guys out there. That'll be December 2nd and 3rd. So if you can be there, plan on it.
I'll be there.
Anybody, all right. Anybody else interested in doing that, give me a holler. But I think this is as good a place as any to stop, man. I think let's try to make this regular, maybe every other week or once a month. Just check in, see what you got going on, see where the show's headed, see what your if your schedule ever comes together like my own.
Right.
They never seem to, but we always are willing to make adjustments last second, willing to get dogs in and people in.
Well, with hunting and traveling, you got to kind of be ready for that.
Yeah.
But as always, Grayson, it's a pleasure. Thank you for having me. Sure. We'll check in with you. We're kind of in a holding pattern with Backroads and Bird Dogs right now. Finished full editing on this last show and get it out. But I think what we'll look at is probably YouTube to begin with, and we've seen some interest from a couple of different the outdoor networks, but I don't know, there's logistics to work out on that, and that's going to take us a minute.
I'll refrain from too many opinions, but what I will say is I think YouTube's where we're at now as a culture. So there's so many different opportunities, but YouTube's a heck of a platform. So
I know, and you dial up what you want up. And that's what I like about it. You don't have to watch any nonsense or bullshit.
Well, and what we need to really talk about putting Connell in charge of this thing. So it's more smoothly.
Oh, no. We may have to have two different versions of it.
But I look forward to seeing you, boys. Thank you very much for being on with me. And we'll check in with you before too much longer, man.
Good to talk with you, Grayson. Talk to you soon, buddy.
All right. Y'all take care.
All right. See you, bud.
Hey listeners, Nick Larson here, host of the Birdshot Podcast. As fans of this show, you may be interested in the conversations on the Birdshot Podcast, where we discuss all things upland hunting, from upland birds and their habitat and conservation, to the shotguns, bird dogs, and gear used to pursue them. Whether you're a seasoned upland hunter or just getting started and wanting to learn more, I interview a wide range of guests, each with their own unique perspective and valuable experience to share. If you're on the hunt for more upland hunting conversation, please consider subscribing to the Birdshot Podcast today. We'll be right back.